This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen, and my guest today is Roger Morgan Grenville. Now, Roger is a man with quite a history. He's a former soldier. He's the author of a number of books on subjects from the game of cricket to the Manx shearwater. At the moment, he's undertaking a very, very long walk from the south of England to Cape Wrath in the north of Scotland. Why? Well, he's trying to highlight the decline of the country's largest wading bird, the curlew. Now, part of our chat on the curlew featured in our Out of Doors programme, but as you'll hear, our conversation ranged far and wide on a whole variety of topics. I met up with Roger on his walk as he approached Dalwhinnie in the Highlands.
Well, the walk, I guess, has three angles to it. The easiest one is I'm 62, I needed an adventure. And let me tell you, 660 miles, it's an adventure.
That's an adventure.
That's an adventure, that'll do. The second one is to draw attention to and funds for what we do at the Curlew Action. Because people know inevitably end up walking with people, and I've talked in the odd village hall and things about curlews. So that's the second. The third one is I'm writing a book on biodiversity restoration projects. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues is a lot of these books, very understandably, are quite sad and quite preachy. And I felt, well, and I felt people kept saying to me, we want a book about hope. So this is the theme of this book is, do I have permission to hope? And so what I'm doing is picking about 15 biodiversity restoration projects in 12 different habitats. So coastal, rock, mountain, forest, whatever. And just chatting in a bit of depth to the people who are doing them. That leads to other projects. And so you get on a rabbit hole. You start looking at Caledonian forestry and you end up looking at beavers. And the whole thing is, at the end of it, do I feel we're on the right track or the wrong track? And if you were to say, well, okay, you're 660 miles in, what do you feel? And I think, you know, a degree of optimism tempered with this unbelievable frustration that so much of the damage we do, governments do and corporations do and we do ourselves, we know when we're doing it what it's doing.
I spoke to an ecologist just last year. And I said, you know, this is a fantastic place to work and, you know, you must get a lot of satisfaction out of this. And he says, well, it's the whole thing about, you know, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. He says, I see all sorts of stuff wrong with this that most people don't. And that's really difficult.
It's very difficult, and it's very difficult to strike the balance, particularly when you're writing about it publicly, between hopeless, mindless optimism and just kind of getting in your bunker and saying, well, it's all gone wrong, we can't do anything about it. Here's the thing, as far as I'm concerned, that over the last 80 years, and it is 80 years, it's kind of 1945, 47, we've denatured everything around us. We've denatured farming, principally, and that's the biggest thing of all. But we've also denatured churchyards, we've denatured cricket pitches, we've denatured gardens to a large extent with the chemicals. And we, above all, we've denatured schools. And so on this happy day when the government down south is announcing a natural history GCSE, which we've been campaigning for 5 years, you sort of have this tingle of hope that, because unless you start with the next generation, you haven't got a hope. Yeah. The way I see it is, you know, everyone talks about rewilding, and it's a lot of rewilding, very exciting. But it's also the most misunderstood term I've come across on my walk. Because people go, oh, well, I tell you what we need to do, we need to rewild. And you go, what does that mean? Yeah. Actually, I want to use the term renaturing. Because, you know, we need food. We can't just rewild everything. And I'm doing a project on a farm down south where 85% of it intensive food production, 15% is corridors of sort of nature. It might be headlands and hedges and ditches and dew ponds. And I've never seen wildlife like you see down there. Mm. And it's not even organic. The other 85% is full on intensive farming. Mm. So That's kind of the direction I'm coming from.
Tell me when you started your walk.
Well, I started on the 7th of March. Mm-hmm. And then on the 10th of March, my neighbour sent me a text saying, better test yourself. I've just turned positive. So I got COVID 4 days into the walk, but luckily very mildly. So what I started in Lymington, which is just outside Southampton on the south coast, and everyone goes, why did you start in Lymington? Well, the answer is it's a much shorter walk to mm-hmm. Cape Wrath than it would be from Land's End.
True.
And
that's over 800 miles.
And I came up through the New Forest, across Salisbury Plain, through the Cotswolds, up into Derbyshire, up the Pennine Way, mm-hmm. and then through the kind of forestry and on the borders, up the Tweed, into Edinburgh, over Schiehallion, and sort of where we are now. And then I actually made the mistake of looking at a full-on map of Scotland yesterday to see how far I thought
Dublin, nearly there,
no, I thought Dublin is about there, but nah.
Scotland's bigger than you think. It's a third of the UK landmass.
Well, also, it's half my walk.
Yeah.
You could literally fold on the border, and it's half.
Wow.
And you know, you're being very hospitable with your weather, I have to say.
It's like this all the time,
yeah,
Roger.
Yeah, I've got, yes.
All the time.
I notice it.
We worry about the lack of rain sometimes.
Well, I was walking up Loch Garry the other day, and it's got a half-mile beach at each end.
Yeah. Yeah, no, joking aside, it's been a very, very dry winter. I was in Loch Tay yesterday. And, you know, it's surprising. The water level must be about 4 or 5 feet lower than I would expect it.
And I think I'm not trying to, in the book I'm writing, I'm not really going to talk much about climate change other than where it impacts on biodiversity, because it's just another huge subject and lots of people writing about it. But there are two factors of climate change that impinge. One is that spring used to go south to north at 1.1 miles an hour. It's now nearly double that. So,
see, I read that and that fascinates me. I'd never thought about basically spring creeping north at a set rate.
Well, if you aggregate everything that a spring is involved, like when the frog spawn appears, mm-hmm. when the first swallow appears, the hawthorn coming out, an oak, you know, all that, that was the figure until about 1990. Uh-huh. But it's now 1.9 miles an hour.
Okay.
And I think the research came from Coventry University, if anyone wants to look it up. And that matters a lot, partly because nature isn't resting. So, you know, we had daffodils on our lawn in Sussex on Boxing Day. That shouldn't be happening. But the other side of the thing is that you're getting these long, dry springs, and then you're getting these very, very wet early summers. So May and June and July are becoming much wetter months, which is rubbish if you're a ground nesting bird or something, because you just get flooded off your thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no.
What we're walking through at the moment, I mean, you've got the A9 on the right-hand side, you know, there's still snow in the hills behind us. It's a broad-ish valley, river running through the middle of that. Lots of gulls and things, but, you know, it's a beautiful day. It's drier than it ought to be at this time of year.
It's much drier, and I was getting advice, because one of the things I was worried about, because I'm doing quite a lot of cross-country further on in the walk, mm-hmm. was getting across burns. Mm-hmm. And everyone said, well, be careful, because that little burn on the map might be 10-foot torrent. Mm-hmm. But they're all saying, well, actually, probably not now. They're probably just little burns that you can cross. But there must be a cost to it in nature. If it sort of goes against what nature is used to. And I can see the cost in ground nesting birds, but there must be costs all over the place. And I sort of find myself softening a bit. And we're walking. You can't see this on radio, but this is an absolutely beautiful scene, looking across the blue sky and blue mountains. And what a place to be. Then a Sitka spruce forest, but we'll let that pass.
And litter on our right-hand side, because we're just going past the lay by a massive amount of litter.
Very interesting factor for you. I don't know if this has any place in an outdoor programme, but the litter changes from England to Scotland.
Oh.
Ah, and it changes from Red Bull to Arnbrew. Actually, there's a Red Bull can there.
Other soft drinks are available.
But in both countries, and I'm sure everywhere else in the UK, you've got this idea that you drive through this beautiful place, what a good idea, open the window and chuck out your lunch. And I was sort of talking to people the other day who do a litter pick down here.
Yeah.
And what goes through your mind if you're doing a litter pick by a busy main road? Stuff that never needed to be thrown out.
Yeah. I've often thought, certainly fast food outlets are incredibly well organised. You know, they are a global phenomenon. They work exactly the same way. It doesn't matter whether it's in, you know, Moscow or Manchester. Surely it cannot be beyond the wit of man that when somebody buys something, there's an identifier on it. So that if you pick it up at the side of the road, you can say, where did that come from?
Ah, well, you're straying onto when I'm Prime Minister manifesto.
Oh, right. Yeah, right, fair enough.
And that's because
can I be Chancellor?
Yeah, you can.
The country's doomed.
But that goes. but you, every time anyone goes into a fast food thing, if it's a vehicle one, their registration number is imprinted automatically on the box or the cup. And other of my policies, just as you're thinking about voting in the local elections, would be a complete ban on plastic grass. I went past a new build little estate in North Yorkshire. Really beautiful. I mean, they'd done a fantastic job on the houses in sort of vernacular stone. It all looked great. And they all had plastic lawns. And you thought, what is that about? Yeah. Basically, if you imitate nature, you're probably doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. If you ask yourself, what would nature do?
Yeah.
Nature wouldn't open the window and chuck a burger box out.
Yeah.
Nature would grow grass and weeds on that lawn. It wouldn't put a plastic thing on it. And worth remembering that every single bit of plastic ever made is still in existence. So it's just incremental.
I remember it must be knocking around 20 years ago, I did a programme and it was an environmental series called Fresh Air. And one of the programmes we did was on waste and how long stuff took to biodegrade. And somebody had mined a landfill site in Liverpool. And they were finding, not forget the plastic, they were finding newspapers. It was so lacking in air or the ability for bacteria to break things down in there. They were finding newspapers 25 years old that were perfectly legible. That's scary.
It is scary. But the waste thing, you know, this idea that we can get to a sort of, as they say, a carbon neutral world in 2050 with not a hair shirt in sight. Bring on the hair shirt. We need to have a world where, in the right circumstances, less is a good thing, not a bad thing. You know, less choice. This crazy notion that if you go into one of the biggest superstores, that you'll have 41,000 things to choose from, and of which, you know, there'll be 238 different coffees.
Yeah.
Really? Because each one of those has got a price in packaging, in transport, in fossil fuel. Could we not go back to a point where, I'm not saying we go back to the 60s where you had nasty coffee and even nastier chicory coffee, but you could just have...
Came in a bottle. I can remember the
with a picture of a soldier on the front.
That's it.
In a kilt.
Camp coffee.
It was.
It was foul.
It was awful. But I'm well aware that I'm talking in a world where millions have no choice at all, let alone enough. But more though, there are more of us who have too much than have too little. There is a kind of feeling that if the ones of us who have too much choose from slightly less, we're straying into sort of philosophy now, but go back to my walk, here my creaky old backpack is just, that's my world at the moment. Okay, my world expands in the evening to other people's drinks cupboards and the contents of their fridge, which is delightful. But in the daytime, I stop and I don't think, what'll I have for lunch? I'll have the piece I bought, and that's it. And it's lovely. I love it.
This is potentially a loaded question because it is very sensitive. A lot of people suffered, an awful lot of people died. But how did you find the experience of the first lockdown?
It is a loaded question, and I have to give an honest answer. I've got a nice house with a nice garden. My kids came home. One of them bought a girlfriend. We had a lovely time. Yeah. I'm acutely aware that if you were in a tenement block, you did not have a lovely time.
Yeah.
And I'm getting very frustrated where people put social media posts up of, you know, we're drinking gin in the garden for the fifth day and it's absolutely lovely. And you go, well, yeah.
I was thinking more in terms of the fact that, you know, that the skies were silent.
The sky.
You know, the first time the car started coming back on the road and it's half a mile away from us, I could hear it very clearly. The birds were making more of an effort, all of the above.
And I think also just a lot of people who'd never met nature or never really been politely introduced to nature, were politely introduced, and have stuck with it. You know, I think I know people who weren't particularly interested, who then said, well, you know, when we started being gradually unlocked and getting out, would go, wow, this is 8 miles from London and it's absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yep, and it's been there for...
Yeah, forever.
Forever. Mm-hmm. So, and I do think...
And if you look after it, it will be there in another 100 years.
If you look, yeah. But I do think that COVID, though, in itself, however it started, the chances were it was transmitted to the humans via an illegally traded pangolin, because that's kind of the general route. It's the way we live. And if we can live in a, you know, a way that mimics nature, that's the word, mimics nature, then, and I know that sounds all sort of idealistic and right here on this lovely morning, but you do get the sense this is not a lost battle. This is just, at the moment, we're struggling to know what our job is on this planet.
Yeah.
And we think our job on this planet is to reach our time at the end of it with as many possessions as we possibly can.
Constant growth.
And I don't think constant growth has no logical end point.
No. I think I know what you mean about mimicking nature, but, you know, it's depending on how you define it. Some folks say, well, plastic grass, it is mimicking nature. No. Well, the way I would define it is we follow the same laws as nature. Nature doesn't produce anything that can't biodegrade, that doesn't have a secondary use, that doesn't recycle in some shape or form. That, you know, the circle is the shape, you know, in terms of processes, which is most common in nature. It's not this travel as fast as you can in a straight line, get to the top and then burn out.
And that's exactly my attitude, which is because if you're doing what nature does, one of the things you're going to do is you're going to do it slower, generally, because that's how nature works. And you're going to do it in a less sort of clunky way. You tread more lightly around the place. And then, you know, I've been into two cities on my walk, Sheffield and Edinburgh. And you arrive with all these, you know, you come off the peat district and come down to Sheffield, and you arrive with all these sort of ideas in your head about peat re-wetting projects and grass flying around, and then you get in the city centre and you go, oh, hang on. And you know, you walk down Prince's Street and you see that the sort of retail version of those 41,000 bits of choice.
Yeah.
But it's not good enough to blame cities and blame, you know, you've actually got to make it needs a shift in the way we think and in our expectations of what we're provided with.
Coming to the curlew. You know, you have this bird, largest wader in the UK, brown, beautiful song. It's an unlikely emblem for a sort of complete sea change in how we live. But you have to pick something. You know, and you could do a lot worse.
Well, it's my emblem, and it's what I came into this a rather strange way. The last time we spoke, we were talking about a book I wrote on seabirds.
Mm-hmm.
When I was beginning to... there were three birds I wanted to write about, to pick from. And one was the Manx shearwater, which I did. One was an albatross, wandering albatross. And one was a curlew. And the wandering albatross, I would need to go 8,000 miles every time I wanted to see it. And the curlew, my friend and colleague, Mary Colwell, who had written this beautiful book called Curlew Moon, which got a huge amount of people energised on it, and she walked from the west coast of Ireland through the island of Ireland and Britain during a breeding season, and basically asked the question, said, you're losing them, you know, and what are you going to do about it? So that's where I came in, and I contacted her and said, well, by the way, you nicked my idea of a book, but I think you wrote rather a better book than I would have done.
Which is even more irritating.
And actually, Mary's the one who's been down south pushing this natural history GCSE, and she'll be a delighted woman this morning. But I think you're right. Ideas need totems, and the curlew...
That's a good word, actually.
The curlew's a good totem. It's because it's a pretty bird with an absolutely heart-rendingly beautiful song.
You ever been to Orkney?
No, I want to go there.
Yeah, well, Orkney's fabulous, but I mean, it's again, there's evidence there, things like the Tomb of the Eagles and what have you, of what you might describe as totemic animals. It's always the way I've thought of it. Anyway, it may not have been the case, but you know, every time I see something like that, I think there was a people who looked at a particular species, adopted it, not just as a totem, but as a roadmap for their behaviour.
And that's one of the reasons I want to go to Orkney, that there is still this abundance of wildlife dovetailing into real, real history.
Tell you, you'll see hundreds of curlew too.
And you see hundreds
you will.
Of curlew. So I think with this totemic animal that you can, you know, you can make into a badge or just a nice logo, it might be the thing that gets people thinking. And as we've said before, you have to very carefully unpick. You know, it's all very well saying, right, no more silage. But actually, silage is an incredibly important part of feeding beasts over the winter. Yeah. You can't just... But you can discover other ways of doing it. And so you can do it later, or you can do it in different ways, or you can leave little bits of the field. Mm-hmm.
I remember talking to farmers years ago, when machines are smaller and time was less tight, that they would be going through the crop and literally stopping the tractor, getting out, moving the eggs off to one side, coming back in, blah, 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 you know, and then they'd move the eggs back into position and things, you know?
Oh, I've met farmers who still do that. Mm-hmm. And down on the sort of the huge Lammas meadows in the Avon Vale, where, you know, people with enormous machinery, they care. And
farmers do.
It's very...
On the whole, farmers really care.
And it's one of the things that we always talk about, you know, grumpy farmers and grumpy farmers being part of the problem. That's not what I've seen. I think the average farmer wants to produce great quality food without destroying the nature around. Mm.
To do that, they have to get the right money for it.
To do that, they have to get the right...
And we haven't paid the right money for food since the Second World War.
Correct. And I think in the UK, we spend 8% of our, famously 8% of our income on food. It used to be 16, still is 16 in France. Yeah. And we are the nation with the third lowest expenditure, with just, I think, USA and Singapore below us. Yeah. And there's always a thing of, there's cheap food and there's honestly priced food. Yeah. And the food in the UK is dishonestly priced, and that's way beyond us. But again, it's a very sensitive subject, because there are an awful lot of people in food poverty who will be sitting and listening, well, no, thanks a lot. I can't even afford it where it is. But there are ways. Governments are powerful creatures. They can actually make these things.
Well, that became apparent during COVID.
Yeah,
governments can do what they want to do. You know, if it's not an issue of political dogma, if it's necessity, you know, and again, using COVID as an example, overnight, we completely changed the way society operated. Now, you could argue as to the sustainability of that change, but we did it. It is possible.
And they showed every sign of enjoying doing it. Because, you know, I think... I agree with you. I think that ironically, as someone who's sort of basically democratic, the electoral cycle is almost the biggest problem in the environment, because you have all these governments with a five-year thing saying, oh, I don't want to annoy people. Yeah. And sometimes you just, all the time in my case, you just think, get a national government that's just got a mandate to get on top of this whole issue. And wrapped up in that is the issue of the way we live and mental health. But to enable people in deprivation to get into the country, that isn't just a sort of lovely middle class aspiration. It's something that, you know, green reduces your blood pressure. One of the privileges I've found in this is I've been outside for 7 weeks.
Your blood pressure gets any lower, you'll fall over.
Well, I go into buildings at night to drink beer and eat stuff. Actually, I went dry for 100 days to...
Really?
Yeah, to reduce... I needed to lose 10 kilos, which you might not think of, but I have. I'm busy putting it on now. The 100 days is up.
The walking that you've been doing, I mean, I can hear your rucksack creaking away in the background there and what have you.
That's not my rucksack, that's my bones.
That's my knees. Yeah, quite. So what sort of proportion have you been camping out? What sort of proportion have you been B&Bing?
Well,
scrounging off friends.
Well, I haven't camped a night yet.
All right, good man.
I figured that my rucksack's 15 kilos, I'm 62,
yeah.
Is just about doable. But if you camp and you've got the tent and the carry mat and the cooker and the sleeping bag and the food, that goes up by 10 kilos pretty quickly.
Yeah, and that's murder.
And I've stayed. One of the really lovely things is I've stayed with friends and friends of friends and friends of friends of friends. So quite often I turn up at a house, I've never met them, they've never met me.
Uh-huh.
And this is the other side of it, that they've got a story to tell. And again, when I'm walking, you know, most of my life, if I'm walking, I walk on my own, I don't disturb people. But now I actually greet people who walk past, or a farmer looking at everything. And very often, they're happy for a chat.
Yeah.
And what you do is you build up an idea of what people think that's based on more than just the newspaper you read or the TV programme you watch. And quite often I've had a very fixed view about something that turns out, you know, after a few, talking to a few people, you go, well, maybe I'm wrong on that. Mm-hmm. And I walk about 20 miles a day on the flat, 16, 17 miles on the hills. And then if I get the navigation wrong, you push it up to 24. I try and cut across between roads. So a lot of the roads in Scotland are east-west, a lot of the valleys. And then you get these sort of 15, 18-mile convenient day-sized packages. So tomorrow I've got a two-day thing over to Fort Augustus. And then I get over again to to Glen Affric. And then up a sort of round up Allerdale. What I worry about is, what am I going to do when I finish it? Because it's
there's an element of pilgrimage about it too, Phil. Because the fact that you are effectively relying on the kindness of distant friends and strangers, you know, you've got to approach it with a certain degree of humility.
That's absolutely right. And also, as someone, you know, one of my biggest sins in my life is I overthink everything. You can't overthink this. And I was advised by someone on day one, live in the day, not in the destination. Because if you have this idea that I'm still so far from Cape Wrath, what am I going to do? You'll be absolutely miserable. So I live in the day, and then at the end of the day, I pitch up where I am, go on Wi-Fi if I can, see what the forecast is like the next day, look if my route looks daft, can I get some lunch, and then I'm off. And life is incredibly simple. You know, the average person starts the day by looking there and thinking, what colour shirt am I going to wear? What breakfast cereal am I going to have? All I do is, which foot's going to go in front of the other one?
Yeah.
When I was planning it, I plan everything down to the, you know, down to the last detail. I'm going to walk past the shop, right at the bar, lunch there. I have my laundry done there. I should wash my clothes. Nah, it doesn't work like that. You just do what you do and chat to people and don't obsess about the journey. You talked about pilgrimage. And again, the same person said, you know, allow this to be a pilgrimage in the sense that you're allowing it to change you, not as a religious experience, but as something.
Yeah.
And it does. It's made me much calmer. And I still, you know, you get very cross about some of the stuff you see and hear, but overall, there's an awful lot of people trying to get the right thing done out here.
Yeah. There's a lot to be said for, you know, this kind of life, embracing the accidents too. One of the best bits of advice, I did the West Highland Way a couple of years ago, and I spoke to two ladies at the beginning of it who had, I think between them, one had done it 6 times and one had done it 7 times. You know, it's 96 miles. And I said, you know, what advice would you give me? And she said, stop and look back occasionally. You know?
That's so true.
Yeah.
But that thing of embracing the accidents, that's a really good thing. The other thing I'd add to that is avoid distractions. And I'm still on the same charge on my ear pods that I left home with 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I just don't use them.
Yeah.
Because if you are writing about nature, how the hell can
Why would you cut yourself off from it?
How the hell can you write about it if you can't even hear it?
Yeah.
I look at BBC News headlines in the morning, but there's nothing much I can do about any of it. But what I can do is give this trip the respect it deserves. I'm very privileged to be able to do this.
Hugely.
I think a lot of people all over the world who give their eye teeth to do this.
Roger Morgan Grenfell there. My thanks to him and good luck to him on the rest of the walk. I really enjoyed. I was with him for maybe 2 or 3 hours or something like that. Fascinating guy, really easy company. This has been the Scotland Outdoors Podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. Thanks for listening.